Hi everybody, I'd like to introduce our next speaker, which is Katia Logue, who's from the University of Warwick. And Katia is doing her PhD on Cormac McCarthy, and she's got the prize for the coolest title, Cormac McCarthy, Mementos of the Broken Body. Fantastic. I'm also really, really pleased to have Katia up here because she is possibly the best person on Cormac McCarthy in the country. I have pressed the record button, David, yes. Thanks, Dave. Katia knows Cormac McCarthy inside out, so I'm really looking forward to it. And the title of your paper is Caecilia and the Physics of Dreaming.
Physicality of Dreaming.
Over to you, Katia.
Yeah, no pressure, Sarah, as the best person on McCarthy in the country. Fantastic. When Patrick first talked about this workshop, so my idea sort of was we were going to meet in the late afternoon, have a lot of wine, and talk about it. And then a couple of weeks ago, he was like, "What's the title of your paper?" And my initial reaction was, "I'm giving a paper." The paper might well be a little bit disorganized or disconnected, because I'm just throwing around ideas as we do, you know, what, 2 months after something new has come out. But I'm looking forward to talking about it because it does speak back to what Patrick and Chris have been speaking about before. So the problem McCarthy addresses in his non-fiction piece, in The Caecilia Problem, it seems to me links back directly to some of the core problems he is both addressing and strategizing with in his fictional work. The first of these problems is of the insufficiency of language itself, or rather the imprecision of language as a whole. This may seem a bit of a tall claim given the full and poetic language of his work, but what McCarthy does with language is describing processes in as much or as little detail as seems appropriate. If we think, for example, of the Legion of Horribles scene in Blood Meridian, and I wish I'd brought a printout because I'm now aware that not everybody's read Blood Meridian, but it's a beautiful scene. It's on page 55 and 56. It's just absolutely wonderful. Well, once you've read it a couple, oh, fantastic. Once you've read it a couple of times, everybody brought Blue Meridian. Fantastic. Okay, so I'm just gonna read two or three sentences. This is the wrong copy. 55. Do you have the Legion of Horribles quote, Dan?
Do you
have the Legion of Horribles quote ready?
Sorry.
I do have it on my phone. I'm going to try read it from my phone. Because Kindle. So the quote, and just a little bit of that is, "A legion of horribles, hundreds in number, half naked or clad in costumes, attic or biblical, or wardrobed out of a fevered dream, with the skins of animals and silk finery and pieces of uniform still tracked with the blot of prior owners, coats of slain dragoons, frogged and braided cavalry jackets, one in a stovepipe hat and one with an umbrella, and one in white stockings and a blood-stained wedding wheel, and some in headgear and crane feathers of raw helmet that bore the horns of bull or buffalo, and one in a pigeon's head coat worn backwards and otherwise naked, and one in an armor of a Spanish conquistador." It's 21 lines long, one sentence. It's absolutely stunning and a very detailed image of a bunch of Comanches riding at Captain White's detail, and it seems a very, very comprehensive image. If you haven't read it, you obviously need to go home and read it now. But in the scene, with all its detail, we cannot possibly, just from the language, actually receive the full image. It would take probably a separate book of a similar size as the actual novel to create something like a full image with language of what is riding at Captain White and his bloodhounds. Yet we all know what that scene looks like when we've read it, and we get more detail every time we read it because we see it in our minds or behind our eyes. It is the language in that scene, as insufficient as it is at, in giving the full picture, does create the full picture. Something very similar is true, I think, for McCarthy's characters. I feel I need not reiterate the rarity with which the author gives any insights into his character's psychology. Yet we do somehow and on some level understand them, or at least follow them. And in addition to the lack of in-depth, many McCarthy characters are not very verbose at all. Those who speak often speak without being heard, like Lester Ballard, or they speak in riddles and metaphors like Judge Holden or Antoine Gigor or John Grady Cole and almost all of the blind and old people in his work. But especially in the Border Trilogy, the blind and the old speak in riddles and images and this kind of thing. And it follows then that McCarthy uses language both in narration and in character speech in order to create a full image of the scene in his readers' minds. McCarthy has, I believe, long ago recognized the insufficiency of language and is relying on its power to create images rather than its precision in describing them. And this, of course, leads directly back to the Kekulé problem. As McCarthy says, languages are charged with describing the world in the Kekulé problem. It seems to me that the unconscious, as McCarthy calls it, is not communicating truth in language, because language is not precise enough, cannot actually communicate that which is important. Language, in short, does not provide the full picture. The problem then is much less why the unconscious is not talking to us in language, and much more why we have unlearned to understand the imagery we are being provided with in the communications we receive from it. Especially since we continue to use language to create fuller images. During his interview on opera, McCarthy states that, quote, the unconscious is a biological system before it is anything else, and this is roughly 10 years before he writes the Kekulé problem, where he reiterates that idea. And it is, I believe, where we can begin to look for a possible answer to some of the many questions McCarthy poses in the Kekulé problem. If the unconscious is a biological system, then it is not necessarily or exclusively located in the brain. Or to go back even a little further than that, maybe we need to be reminded that the brain, where we have located the rational, the conscious, and the unconscious, by some sort of silent agreement, the brain is located in the body. It is first and foremost physiological matter. Why then do we assume that the unconscious or the conscious or the rational, for that matter, would limit themselves to that part of the body exclusively? Literally nothing else in the body is in only one place. Everything is connected with each other. Everything communicates with each other, much like a rhizome, although this is not a Deleuzean reading at all. When we limit the conscious or the unconscious or the rational to the brain only, we ignore roughly 98% of the other matter that is the body. The brain, and with that, the unconscious, if it is really located or locatable, is part of a system that is infinitely connected within itself. Again, like a rhizome, it is talking to each other. We are within a boundary, constantly communicating with every part of our body. It's actually quite uncomfortable to sit the way I am right now. And I know that while giving a paper. This is something we know. If we accept the brain as primary location of the unconscious, as well as part of the rhizomatic system of the material body, then the unconscious is really knowledge generated in our body. That is, the unconscious is embodied knowledge, quite possibly, and I'm aware that I'm leaning out far out of the window here, It is the combined embodied knowledge generated through affect and experience and of some sort of Jungian primal experience or collective unconscious. So affect and experience and a collective unconscious, that is what, for me at least, at this stage, is the unconscious. Brian Massumi supports this this claim in his discussion of affect in Parables of the Virtual, while at the same time several historians of emotions, including Barbara Rosamond, would probably disagree. But it is a physical, the physical dimension to it is not communicable. But this is why language relies so very heavily on metaphor and simile. If we attempt to describe to a friend or a doctor what exactly the pain we currently experience feels like, it is always like a burning sensation under the skin. There's not usually actually fire under your skin. It is as if somebody was stabbing you with a pointy object, although your physical integrity is not currently being broken by a screwdriver or a similar device. We use metaphor and simile to explain sensation to within as close to the reality as we can, while being unable to relay exactly what our profoundly embodied experiences actually are. But the unconscious does not have to do that, because it can show us the imagery that relates exactly to the situation. It is not there to problem solve for us, but to show us images that help us physiolocate the problem and thus change our narrow language-based perspective. That we haven't learned to understand these images is really not our unconscious's problem, our bodies, or our bodies for that matter. Am I for time?
Yeah, you've got a couple of minutes, yeah.
Okay. To return to my initial point about the correlation between McCarthy's fiction and the Kekulé problem, the author's awareness of the insufficiency of language, or the more precise and full communication possible through images, shows, to my understanding of the text, his focus on the physicality of things in the first place. There is a mountain of scholarship, of course, on McCarthy's landscape, so we'll not go into detail here. I'd like to focus on McCarthy's representation of the material body and on the dreams he gives his characters. I believe that the reason we have some sort of understanding of McCarthy's characters lies in the precise description of their physicality. Of their physicality and thus the generation of those bodies, of the body as image. We understand that Outer Dark's Tinker is a mean and disillusioned character because his body has actually changed into a cart-pulling machine, has been crippled by decades of pulling his wares and receiving abuse for his existence. In the same novel, we understand Rinthy's somewhat off relationship with the people around her because we may have an idea of what it must be like to be hungry and to have walked endless miles. As a woman, I can also empathize with her aching breasts that will not stop producing milk, even if I've never had my own child. Those of us who have been hungover before, understand Sutree's parched wanderings through Knoxville's wastescapes. We understand John Grady's drive manifest in the many scars he receives, Billy's pain and determination to return things and people to their rightful place after he has abandoned his rightful place himself and has received nothing but pain and loss from it. We even to some degree understand Lester Ballard, who has been abandoned and ignored and even violated by his community. Those we do not understand are those whose physicality is alien to us, monstrous even. The judge with his enormous physique and strangely childlike face, Antoine Chigurh with his feigned exoticism, the marauding gangs of cannibals in the road, although we may have reserved in some corner clemency for them, simply because their position in life cannot possibly be mirrored in our understood through our sum of experience, which is exactly what we are. We understand McCarthy's characters then through their physicality, or accept that they are beyond comprehension based on the same logic. I'm about to finish. And what is not in the characters' bodies is in their dreams, or in the dreamlikeness of their situation. What does the judge mean when he, in the desert, he asks the kid that perhaps he, the kid, has seen this place in a dream, that he would die there? What does Blood Meridian's dreamlike epilogue mean? Why is Sudri inducing a dreamlike state in himself that is fueled by hunger and mushrooms as much as by his existential desire to understand the world? Why is Sheriff Bell's father carrying the fire on ahead? I believe that these characters, McCarthy's dreamers, return into their bodies to look for the answers that the novels have been posing, and McCarthy's inviting us to do the same, to join that journey. He's taking us deep within his characters' embodied knowledge to show us images that we ought to learn to comprehend, but that are beyond text. I'm not claiming that McCarthy comprehends these images himself, nor me, for that matter. But I believe that the character's unconsciousness is imparting knowledge through a retreat into the embodied world, the physical world of the dream, as gateway to access embodied knowledge and a different understanding of the world. And there is more than one answer, of course, because everything has more than one answer. Even Harold Bloom is throwing throwing a tantrum about that in Blood Meridian. The unconscious, then, is providing all the answers to the problem, because imagery that can do that, whereas language cannot. This is why Kekulé could solve his benzene molecule problem, because he could access embodied knowledge that was, for the moment, beyond language. Thank you.
Thank you, Katya. Lots of stuff there. What I'm interested in, I was wondering, what you talk a lot about sort of the physicality, you talk about a lot about material, you talk about brain processes. I'm wondering, is something we could do to sort of figure out what's going on in this text is what exactly is, you think, what is the status of matter in this, or materialism? I don't think, maybe correct me if I'm wrong, I don't think we could say that Cormac McCarthy is like a strict philosophical materialist. He's not like an eliminative materialist, say like a Churchland might be, so that the idea that, you know, everything is reducible to matter. So how didn't you think you would configure that?
I think, or at least that's how I read McCarthy, he is trying to Descartes the communication about the body and the mind. Because we have to be careful to bring Descartes to the table. And we talk about the mind and rationality and the unconscious, and it's somehow up in the hierarchy. And I don't think that McCarthy believes that. Mm. It has its own validity, but it's on the same level as embodied experience and bodily knowledge or bodily or embodied knowledge. I think he's trying to level the hierarchy.
Oh, okay, yeah. So then that brings us down, so it's very sort of, you're kind of trying to configure kind of a cultural embodiment, is that right? Or a very, very sort of, a physical sense of the body.
Yes.
So maybe I guess my question then is, how do you think McCarthy is configuring the body? I know that's your entire project, but...
yeah.
Yeah.
well, give me 80,000 words. I think he, in his work, there is a class aspect to it. He's in none of his work anywhere near interested in the upper class or in any form of educated class. It's all lower class interest. And I think he's propositioning the body as a site of resistance, as a class resistance, where you can write on your body the fights you've been fighting against dominant narratives and dominant culture, and the sort of impositions they put on you. It's very strong in Sartre, where you have, it's mentioned very briefly, but Lou Gillett actually does a beautiful piece on it in her book, the laws, the loitering laws, where in Knoxville at around the time, it was illegal to loiter. The homeless or dispossessed or marginalized were forced to wander constantly, because you're not allowed to lie down anywhere and have a nap unless it's in a house or it's away from the visible. That was one of the projects of, you know, removing the poor people and the marginalized from the visible. And there's an entire set of laws around that. Vagrancy laws, I think they're called. That's why Sartre goes to prison, because he was found sleeping on a park bench.
So the body imaged in, which is a quite striking term you used, the unconscious in, is like, it's a political body.
Yes.
Writing these sort of inequities of class and struggle and oppression. Okay.
And it becomes the resistance and the inequality becomes readable in the body, I think.
So hence scars feature heavily in McCarthy's work.
Yes, absolutely.
And how does that thing, do you think, relate to the idea of the unconscious? I mean, is it a traumatic, you know, the idea of a scar or a trauma?
I'm not entirely sure, because I treated this as slightly separate than I did my PhD thesis anyway. I think that the unconscious in the mistreated or marginalized body becomes much more of a survival mechanism. There are these, again, Satree is beautiful for that. There's these episodes where Satree wakes up somewhere in the middle of nowhere, wakes up completely hungover, doesn't know his own name, doesn't know where he is, and just starts walking. He's absolutely parched. He stinks. Nobody would help him because he's just disgusting and vile. But he keeps going and he keeps thinking in language, because he's one of the few characters we have insights into, in language about his situation. And similar in the same novel, there is a scene towards the end where an idiot woman wakes up after a gang fuck. And the descriptions are very, very similar, although my supervisor says I can't put them together because feminism. But the description of her body are very, very similar. She's been in this gang situation and she must have passed out, she must have been very, very drunk, the same way that Satree sort of always gets into fights and situations that he has no control over and then wakes up somewhere with blood, you know, crusted on his head and just no control over his body, but he still wakes up and there's still a conscious moving from the situation, just sheer experience, into rationalizing what needs to happen. And I think it's somewhere there that the conscious and the unconscious communicate.
Right, so rather than maybe benign, which I was talking about earlier, is not quite the right word.
I would, because there's also grace in benignity or benignity, I would go back to just survival.
Survival,
yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you, Katya.
Thank you.